In the coming week, Belarus holds a presidential election. Discontent simmers throughout eastern Russia. And Japan marks the anniversaries of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki amid discussions of the country's long-term national security strategy. It's August 6, 2020, in time for The World Next Week. I'm Jim Lindsay.
And I'm Sheila Smith, sitting in for Bob McMahon.
Sheila is CFR's Senior Fellow for Japan Studies. Sheila, thank you very much for coming on the show.
I'm excited to be here, Jim. This is great fun. So let's kick off the show by talking about the upcoming presidential election that's set to take place in Belarus. The election is scheduled for this Sunday, August the 9th, and Belarus's sitting president, Alexander Lukashenko, faces a strong challenger. Can you set the scene, Jim, and tell us about this election in Belarus?
Happy to, Sheila. If I were to title it, I would call it Europe's Last Dictator Tries to Hang On. President Lukashenko has held office since 1994. He's seeking a sixth term in office. Now, you have to understand that the Organization for Security and Cooperation, otherwise known as the OSCE, last recognized Belarus as having free and fair elections in 1995. That's because Mr. Lukashenko has been very good about suppressing his political opponents. But that track record may come back to haunt him this time around. In July, two opposition candidates were barred from the election. That prompted protests around the country. One candidate was arrested under false charges, and the other fled to Russia for his own safety. And the reason this is significant is because it has really produced the strongest challenge to Lukashenko's rule. His main rival now is 37-year-old Svetlana Tsikhanouskaya. She jumped into the race in place of her jailed husband. Now, he's a YouTube blogger in Belarus who authorities allege has been collaborating with Russian mercenaries. Now, she's been helped by a partnership that emerged with the wife of another disqualified candidate, as well as with the campaign manager of yet another disqualified candidate. Now, the opposition rallies have drawn huge crowds across the country, and their main argument is that we want free and fair elections. Tsikhanouskaya has argued that once she's elected president, she wants to free political prisoners, oversee a fair election, after which she says she's going to step aside. Now, as we go into the election, I should say that independent polling is illegal in Belarus. Not surprisingly, state-backed polls project that Lukashenko is going to win a landslide victory. Just this week, Lukashenko had independent election observers who were there to observe the vote and who had detailed some election law violations arrested. It certainly seems that Lukashenko thinks he is going to win. He said this week that protests won't be allowed after the election on Sunday. Now, the tradition in Belarus is people take to the streets after the election, usually to argue that they were rigged because, in fact, they have been. And Tsikhanouskaya's campaign manager was detained today, I believe, because of accusations that she was promoting unsanctioned rallies. So I expect that things could be quite tumultuous, Sheila, in Belarus once the election results are posted sometime Sunday night or Monday morning.
It's a fascinating moment of interactions between civil society and the government. It sort of strikes me that social media is being used, or at least a blogger, people who have access to other means of communication and rallying support. Is this the first time, do you know, in this election that this is a venue for candidates, or are we watching in real time some innovative campaign tactics?
Well, I think social media has been used before, but what's different this time around is that the opposition forces, rather than being split, have joined forces in a sense that everyone is fed up with the way things are going in Belarus and that they want to have free and fair elections. That seems to be the glue that's holding the opposition together, which of course raises the challenge, you know, if the opposition succeeds, will they be able to agree on a positive agenda for Belarus beyond holding new elections? But again, it seems that Lukashenko intends to stay in power. He has been playing the Russian card all along, arguing that the Russians have been interfering in the election, arguing that the Russians have sent mercenaries into Belarus, I guess shades of what happened or has happened in Crimea. The Kremlin has denied these charges, calling them unfounded, has been particularly critical because Belarus has arrested 36 or so Russian citizens. And so the tensions between Russia and Belarus are heating up. At the same time, Belarus does not have especially good relations with the United States. We haven't had an ambassador to Belarus since 2008. Now, I know President Trump Trump has nominated someone to be ambassador to Belarus, that person still has not received Senate confirmation.
I wonder, Jim, we're in the middle of this COVID-19 pandemic. Is that a factor, or do you think that's going to be a factor at all in this election, or is it really hard to tell?
Undoubtedly it is, Sheila. I mean, it's important to note that Lukashenko vocally resisted imposing any kinds of restrictions or safeguards to prevent the spread of COVID-19. I think he even argued that people should just drink vodka and go to the sauna as a way to prevent the virus. I should note that he himself has tested positive for COVID-19, so he has firsthand experience with the disease. But my sense is that in Belarus, they have significant problems with COVID. Of course, if you have a government that is not looking to find out how widespread the disease is, you're not going to have very good data on how widespread it in fact is.
So Jim, you mentioned Russia, and so I guess if you wouldn't mind a bit of a pivot here to talk about what's happening there. In the eastern city of Khabarovsk, anti-Kremlin protests have broken out in response to the arrest of a regional governor, Sergei Furgal. I'm not sure what led to Furgal's arrest and why people are protesting. Do you have any insights into what's happening there?
Well, let's begin with what we know of the facts of the case, Sheila, which is that on July 11th, protests began in Khabarovsk, and that was in response to the arrest of this governor. They like to refer to him as Governor Sergei. And these arrest charges relate to a murder that was committed back in 2004. Now, for those listeners who aren't really up on Russian geography, Khabarovsk is located about 4,000 miles east of Moscow, and it's just north of the border with China. Now, Governor Sergei came to office back in 2018 when he defeated the candidate that was put up by Putin's political party. So I think many people in Khabarovsk have come to the conclusion this was a politically motivated arrest, and they have been turning out in the streets daily to make their unhappiness known about the arrest, but I also think to make their unhappiness known about what they see as the shortcomings of President Putin's rule. And they've, you know, been chanting anti-Putin slogans and things like that.
Putin seems to have put himself in a position of being in power for the foreseeable future. You certainly get a sense that he's in a much better position politically in Russia, and yet these demonstrations suggest that there's still a considerable amount of discontent. Do you think this is particular to this region? This is a quite sensitive region, a little closer to the one I know in Asia, being just on the other side of China. Or do you think this is just very particular to the circumstances of this governor's political career?
I think it's really hard for us to say, Sheila. I mean, you've studied countries around the world for a very long time, and sometimes you have protests that begin regionally and they take hold and they sweep the entire country. In other cases, you have regional protests and they peter away. And so I think it's really hard to say. I do think you're right that President Putin intends to stay around for a long time. You may recall last month, a referendum was passed allowing Putin to stay in power until 2036. But Russia has some significant problems. Its economy is not doing terribly well. As you know, the Russian economy depends very heavily on oil and gas. Oil prices, gas prices have fallen sharply. That puts a crimp on the economy. You also have the problem that Russia has been one of the countries hardest hit by COVID-19, in part like many of the other countries that have seen very high death rates from COVID-19. It's because they didn't respond very well to handling the crisis, didn't do the kinds of testing, contact tracing, and quarantining that are required. So this is, you know, essentially sort of look back and you wonder whether this might be something that could ripple throughout the rest of Russia. I would say so far we haven't seen protests breaking out in cities elsewhere in Russia, so that would argue that this is primarily a regional one. But again, it could be that Moscow's handling of the crisis could change things dramatically. And certainly, as you know, Russia has a very long history of local protests that can really grow in size and consequence. Sheila, you mentioned that you have a general sense of this region because you're obviously a scholar of Japan, and Japan has had a longstanding interest in what we would refer to as Northeast Asia. Now, of course, as we're sitting here, today is the 75th anniversary of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima. And I'll note that Sunday will be the 75th anniversary of the bombing of Nagasaki. Now, last week, Bob and I talked a little bit about the anniversaries, but I'd love to hear from you on this. We've already had a very somber ceremony in the city of Hiroshima today, but perhaps you could sort of talk to us a little bit about how these anniversaries are being seen in Japan.
I'd be happy to, Jim. These are 2 days, August 6th and August 9th, which every Japanese knows and every Japanese was raised to stop and reflect at the time of the dropping of the atomic bombs. I think it's important for non-Japanese to understand that these were fairly densely populated cities in the end of World War II. Hiroshima had a population of about 350,000 when the bomb was dropped. Nagasaki was slightly smaller because Nagasaki had been the site of some previous firebombing, but there was about 74,000 people in Nagasaki. Today, there's a little over 100,000 survivors still from both of these cities. People in Japan refer to these as the hibakusha, and they are often on the front row of seats of formal ceremonies in both Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They are elderly now, as you know, that World War II generation, whether we're talking about veterans who fought in the war or civilians who experienced the war, they're now in their mid-80s. I think the average age of the hibakusha is 83. The mayors of both of these cities take an active role on these days. They issue peace declarations, which are really communications not just to Tokyo, but to the rest of the world. The mayor of Hiroshima in today's ceremony, or yesterday in Japan, but today in our time, but he was quite critical of the Abe government for not taking a stronger stance on nuclear nonproliferation. The prime minister gave a speech in Hiroshima, and his speech was quite limited or narrow focused. It wasn't focused on the broad topic of global disarmament, but it's very narrowly focused on how we need to move forward to make a more peaceful world. But, you know, these are one piece of a much more complex fabric of war memory in Asia, and that affects the geopolitics and the relationships between the countries there. Tokyo, the Abe cabinet, in fact, a few weeks ago, made a fairly abrupt decision to move away from a ballistic missile defense system, which was really the way they've been trying to cope with the unsettling pressures on their defenses, especially from North Korea. And that system was going to be built with the United States, and they are now reviewing their national security strategy and redoing their defense plan. And this is quite ambitious because they're trying to do this all within a couple of months before the end of this calendar year. So Japan finds itself today in a kind of unsettled state. It has deep concerns about the nuclear capabilities and the missiles, increasingly mobile, maneuverable missiles that North Korea can launch in its direction. It is always, as you know, concerned about the rising military clout of China and the operations of the Chinese Navy and Air Force in and around the East China Sea, in particular the in and around Taiwan. So Japan is feeling a little bit of pressure militarily. So the juxtaposition, of course, between this remembering of the atomic bombings and the peaceful intent that this peace declaration has for the future of the Japanese people, indeed of the world, is kind of juxtaposed between the increasingly edgy military relationships in Northeast Asia.
Sheila, there's a lot there. Can I draw you out on a couple of points? And maybe I think where I'd first like to begin is sort of how Japanese think of their relations with the United States against this backdrop, this history of the United States having dropped atomic weapons on two Japanese cities. And I will also note that the United States conducted a lot of aerial bombing of Japan during World War II. The firebombing of Tokyo was horrific. The death toll of that bombing, I believe, was even greater than the bombing at Hiroshima. How do the Japanese talk about or teach about this moment, given that right now the United States and Japan are very close allies?
It's a great question, and I think it's changing, Jim. So it used to be that the lesson of World War II that all school children were taught and taught first was the terrible consequences of the atomic bombings in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. For some international observers, this seemed like a rather narrow vision of what happened in World War II. And so you've had some pushback from visitors from Korea and from China, and of course also from the United States, that Japan was very focused on the victimization it faced at the end of World War II. And so you've had an effort to open that conversation further to a much more holistic rendering of the entire history of World War II for the Japanese and to the younger people to be educated. Okinawa is another place that has a leading voice in war memory in Japanese education. Of course, that was the site in June 1945 of the first landing of U.S. forces, what was anticipated at that time of the war to be the first of many landings on homeland islands of Japan. And again, this is prior to the decision to drop the bombs. So you've got different pockets of opinion, Jim, on how to understand the American role. And what I found to be very interesting is, and I think this goes along with the generational change change in Japan is that the fire bombings are now much, much more in the forefront of public ceremony, public remembrance, memorializing than they've ever been in the past. And I think it's because you have a generation of people who lived through them in Tokyo, in Osaka, in Nagasaki, and they want to make sure that these are not forgotten either. And so Ambassador Carolyn Kennedy was the first U.S. ambassador to visit the commemoration in Tokyo and the museum that was dedicated to the fire bombings of Tokyo, just as she was the second U.S. ambassador to visit Hiroshima on their celebration.
And just to be clear, that my understanding is the death toll, and it's very hard to get accurate numbers here, the firebombing of Tokyo may have been north of 100,000 people.
Considerably north of 100,000 people. I think the death toll, I gave you the population numbers at the opening of our segment, but the death toll from the atomic bombings was about 140 in Hiroshima, 140,000, and 74,000 in Nagasaki. I think the firebombing death tolls would be in the 300,000 to 400,000 in Tokyo. But I don't know that we have an exact number, but they are much, much larger, as you pointed out. So there's complex sentiment about the United States, about what happened. There are citizens advocacy groups who think that the United States should be tried for war crimes for the not only the firebombings, but in particular, the atomic bombings. So you've got very critical voices in Tokyo of the use of force by the United States in those culminating years. The larger narrative, however, has been that we have turned the corner, that we are close allies, and there has been some Japanese government push for the United States to take a stronger role, for example, in nuclear nonproliferation. So they were quite supportive, for example, of the Prague speech by President Obama. But they also rely, of course, on our nuclear umbrella for their defenses and for deterring nuclear aggression against them. So it's a complicated public policy stance by the Japanese government.
If I can, I'd like to sort of now look to the future. One of the consequences of Japan's defeat in World War II is it creates a new government, it's a new constitution, and one of the signal provisions in the constitution is Article 9, which governs what we would call defense. And could you sort of talk a little bit about Article 9, what it said, but also my understanding is there's some debate about whether Article 9 still applies for Japan in today's world.
Sure. And if you'll allow me to advertise.
Of course.
On CFR.org, we have a wonderful info guide that looks at Japan's constitutional debate. And in particular, this issue, we drill down a little bit on that. But Article 9, as your listeners may know, was adopted in the 1947 Constitution while Japan was under occupation by the United States. And General Douglas MacArthur took a very leading role in making sure that Japan would face the future in a demilitarized state. And it's interesting, if you go back and read Douglas MacArthur's notes, he really wanted to pacify Japan, not allow it self-defense rights, nothing. He wanted no military capability. But as that time period evolved, the Cold War tensions began to erupt. And then, of course, you had the hot war of the Korean War in the region. By the time peace was negotiated with Japan in San Francisco in 1951, the U.S. was quite anxious that Japan did acquire some military capability to offset the growing capabilities of its neighbors, although not a nuclear capacity. So the United States shifted in that very critical early post-war time period between wanting full demilitarization and then allowing Japan what the Japanese had wanted all along, which is the right of self-defense. Today's military is called the Self-Defense Force, in keeping with the spirit of Article 9. The Japanese people overwhelmingly support Article 9. Most Japanese believe that Article 9 is what allowed Japan to maintain its post-war peace. So you have a very strong public support for the article. Nonetheless, Japanese governments over the last 20 years have gradually seen ways of talking about defense and about military capabilities that are congruent or they say are in following the spirit of a self-defense force, but they are increasingly capable militarily, and their neighbors and sometimes us ask them questions about what the ultimate intent of their acquisitions are. I have a book again on this called Japan Rearmed.
That title again, Sheila?
Oh, one more time, louder. Japan Rearmed, The Politics of Military Power is a book I wrote last year if people are really interested. But one thing to keep an eye on looking forward, as you said, is this fall will be an interesting time to watch the Japanese debate over its military. And I fully anticipate that you'll see many people in the Conservative Party and in the bureaucracy saying it's time for Japan to acquire strike capability, conventional strike capability.
What does that mean, strike? strike capability.
It means that they can reach out and hit somebody else. So ballistic missiles or, you know, cruise missiles, some kind of missile capability that would allow them to retaliate in case they are attacked.
And also, hopefully, if you have the capacity to retaliate, you can deter them from attacking in the first place.
That's the logic.
I'll note the Australians are also saying they're going to make a big investment in strike capability. Now, I want to say, you know, Japan refers to itself as having a self-defense force. And I don't want anyone to come away from our conversation not realizing that the Japanese self-defense force is quite capable, particularly
yes.
in terms of its naval assets.
Right.
So I think it's important to keep in mind, Article 9 does not mean that Japan has no military capability. But what's really striking me, and so you tell the story, is what the U.S. government wanted from Japan has changed over time. And so I was wondering if perhaps, you know, you could sort of just quickly sort of project forward where you think U.S.-Japanese relations are growing, given that we have an occupant of the White House who has been skeptical of allies, talked about how allies haven't done enough. We've just seen orders for troops be reduced in Germany. There have been some very tough negotiations with Japan, also with South Korea, about support for U.S. bases there. You have the rise of China. You have the very real threat posed by North Korea, which, despite all of the unusual diplomacy by President Trump, hasn't changed the basic facts, which is that North Korea is armed to the tooth, has nuclear mm-hmm. weapons, particular animosity toward Japan. So where does Japan go in all this?
We're cozying on up, I think, to some very critical decisions for Tokyo. And I would say one thing, the Trump administration has largely managed the Japanese-U.S.-Japan alliance somewhat better than perhaps it has approached NATO and the U.S.-South Korean alliance. And that's largely because Prime Minister Abe has invested a great deal of political capital.
He gave him golf clubs right at the start of the relationship.
Lots of golf, lots of understanding, lots of jobs. So it here's the thing, the Abe cabinet has invested heavily on the F-35 fighter jet, for example, which is a pretty important platform, right, for the Japanese military. It has agreed to buy them off the shelf instead of producing them at home. So Prime Minister Abe has said, we want to do more for the alliance, but we want to do more that leaves Japan's defense capabilities stronger. What hasn't happened yet, Jim, just in terms of the host nation support, which is the amount in which our allies contribute to basing of U.S. forces forward deployed, is the South Koreans have had a terrible, terrible negotiation with the United States.
Yep.
Trump administration has asked them to quintuple their spending. They have not yet begun with Japan. And so this is the year when, this is right now when we're talking, would be when the diplomats on both sides would be kind of setting the table for negotiations to start in January. So if you have a Trump re-election, let's say, next year, you could see the host nation support talks becoming quite acrimonious in that relationship as well. But the future does not look bright for Japanese defenses. They worry about the reliability of the United States, in the sense that they always worry, right? They are a non-nuclear power. We have the nuclear umbrella. So there's always a degree of strategic concern, right? If we're going to protect them or not. That's true for all our allies. But they also worry that their neighborhood is getting far, far more dangerous for them. And they are an easy target. And if you sit in any of these conversations regionally, you can hear South Koreans, North Koreans, Chinese. They all talk about Japanese militarism and the rise of Japan is terrible. So you see this kind of marginalization of Japanese interests in ways, and of course, this has a lot to do with the legacies of World War II, to take us right back to where we began the conversation on Japan. So these are very tricky conversations. Collaboration is hard, and the United States-Japan partnership is, or security alliance to be more specific, is really the only plan that Japan has to make sure that its security is protected. The alternatives are all not very pretty for Japan.
And I would imagine that if those alternatives are something that Japan has to confront and discuss, it's going to be a very painful discussion, precisely because of where we began. Japan remains the only country to feel the brunt of a nuclear attack, and that, I think, hangs over Japanese society and shapes conversations in a way very different than in many other places.
That's right. That's absolutely right. So I think we need to talk about figures of the week. Is that correct?
That is correct, yeah.
This is the part where I love it. So you get to go first,
okay.
Jim. Who, or rather, what is your figure this week?
My figure of the week is, in fact, a number. It is the number 2,750. And Sheila, that's the number of tons of ammonium nitrate that exploded this week in Beirut. The explosion, which is quite dramatic and you can see it online, has left at least 135 people dead. I suspect that number is going to go much higher. And it turns out that ammonium nitrate had been sitting in the port of Lebanon, apparently for about 6 years. And it is ammonium nitrate that was left over from 2013 when a Moldovan flag cargo ship essentially broke down and wasn't allowed to sail out of the port. Now, Lebanese officials have known about the risks for a number of years, but did not act on them. And we're still getting, you know, more investigation on exactly what caused the explosion, how it started. But certainly, it doesn't paint a very good picture of the Lebanese government. And that takes us to a piece that our colleague Stephen Cook wrote last week before the explosion that appeared in the online journal Foreign Policy titled "Lebanon as We Know It Is Dying." And I think Lebanon is a country under tremendous stress, and that stress is only going to intensify in the wake of this explosion. I will note that among the facilities that were destroyed during the explosion is the country's main grain silo. So the blast has left Lebanon with less than a month's supply of grain reserves. So the future for Lebanon, I think, looks pretty dire. And I guess, you know, if you want to look for glimmers of hope, one possibility is that this can lead to not just criticism, but unification among opponents to try to find a better route forward for Lebanon. But again, Lebanon is a country with very deep sectarian divisions, and it lives in a very dangerous neighborhood where a lot of problems in other countries have spilled over into its borders. But what about you, Sheila? Who or what is your figure of the week?
So mine is a person, and her name is Nadia Murad. She spoke to the United Nations Security Council a couple of days ago. She is a survivor of the genocide committed by ISIL on the Yazidi people in Sinjar province in Iraq. She is a Nobel Peace Laureate due to her activism and her call to justice for ISIL for the way in which they forced young women into sexual slavery. She says that the world has lost its attention. This is the sixth anniversary, of course, of the genocide. And she testifies that about 100,000 Yazidis have returned to their homeland, but they have yet to have access to healthcare or any access to education. They continue to be mistreated. But there's about 3,000 kidnapped women who are still missing.
3,000?
3,000 is the number she provided to the United Nations. I picked her because we are talking about remembrances and anniversaries. But the other reason is because I think we often forget when we talk about foreign policy, the role of citizens and advocates in shaping the debate, the international debate. And so these calls for action, I think, are very important for us to amplify, but also to pay attention to, because these are the people who themselves have suffered. And they have a voice that often we forget about when we talk about the big power relations of the day.
Yeah, certainly a challenge for the Yazidis, just given the general disarray that Iraq finds itself in. Again, another country poorly governed, deeply divided along sectarian lines and ideological lines, and unable really to provide the kind of law and order, for lack of a better phrase, that allows people to sort of live peacefully and to enjoy human dignity. You're quite right. What happened to the Yazidi was truly horrific, and I'm not sure how that can be repaired.
I think it's also true that women in areas and zones of conflict bear a particular burden, and that is the use of rape as a weapon in war, and also the horrors of the sexual slavery that can take place as well. Whether we're looking back at Asia in the first half of the 20th century, or you're looking at conflicts today, the burden on women is something that we need to continue to be aware of, but also to act upon.
I'll just say on that score, since we're in the business of doing plugs, to check out the work done by our colleagues at the Women in Foreign Policy Program at CFR. They've done a lot of work on the plight of women in conflict. They've also doing a lot of work in a current big project on human trafficking, which I think is worth checking out. You can find their work, Sheila's work, Stephen Cook's work at CFR.org.
So that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. Rwanda's President Paul Kagame is to visit Malawi for bilateral talks. The anniversary of the construction of the Berlin Wall will be noted. And U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo plans to visit the Czech Republic.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that the opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the host or our guest, not a CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collins with senior producer Jeremy Shirley. Special thanks to Anna Shortridge, Noah Mulligan, and Aaron Gallagher for their assistance. This week, our recording engineer was none other than Zoe Collins. Thank you, Zoe. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Sheila Smith saying so long.